I'm Linda Cohen-Leugman, and this is the story behind my stories.
You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret White. Terry Brooks.
Sheena Kamal.
Matthew Quick.
J.T. Ellison.
Walt D. Williams.
Brad Ford.
Corey Doctorow.
Brandon Sanders.
Robin Mock.
Ernest Klein. Jim Butcher.
Sherwin Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Linda Cohen-Leugman.
Welcome to Author Stories. Find archives of all the shows at HankGarner.com, and while you're there, never miss an episode by subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, and YouTube. It's free on all platforms. As we get into today's show, I'd like to tell you guys about some incredible new releases that I know you're going to love. The brand new book from Nathan Heistad, Rift, The Resistance, Book 1. They've watched us for centuries through the Rift. They prepared. Invasion is inevitable. The Earth fleet has known of the Watchers for years, unwilling to share the knowledge with humanity. Now it might be too late. Hidden away from the fleet, one man is creating a new colony ship destined for the other side of the Rift, but he's missing a few pieces. Three other people have varied paths to get there. Ace goes from the streets of Earth to the fleet training facility on the moon. Flint, an ex-fleet pilot, must decide if a job is worth his life. And Wren, imprisoned for a secret project years ago, is given hope as an unlikely ally whispers words of escape in her ear. Their journeys lead to Councilman Jordan Fairbanks, who knows of the impending invasion and has prepared. All they can do is wait for the Rift to open once again and see what's on the other side. Rift joins an ensemble cast facing immeasurable obstacles. If you enjoy space battles, prison breaks, androids, and aliens, buried under a shroud of mystery, this book is for you. Try it today. A fresh new fiction adventure from the author of the best-selling Survivor series, Rift, The Resistance, Book 1. Now available. There's a link in the show notes. Also from our friend Rick Partlow, Recon, A War of the Knife. Tyler Callis had a life most people would kill for. He killed to escape it. Tyler is the pampered heir of a high-level corporate council executive, groomed from birth to take a seat beside her as a member of the ruling class of the Commonwealth Society. But the bloody war with the alien Tani has hit close to home, and Tyler wants to join the military, something his powerful mother won't allow. Desperate to escape her control, Tyler changes his identity to Randall Monroe, a product of the poverty-stricken underground, and enlists in the Marines. There he flourishes, becoming a member of an elite force recon unit and striking deep behind enemy lines. But when his platoon is assigned to take back the colony on Demeter from the Tani, the mission falls apart. Most of his comrades are killed, and Monroe is wounded, separated from his unit and left for dead on an enemy-occupied world. With no other choice, he organizes the civilian colonists into a resistance movement and begins fighting against the occupation, with limited supplies and no support. As the situation becomes more and more desperate, what began as a high-tech interstellar conflict will become a war to the knife. Recon, A War to the Knife by Rick Partlow. There's a link to it in the show notes. Book 3 of the Saga of the Iron Dragon, the conclusion of the epic series that began with the Dream of the Iron Dragon. 9th century Iceland, three explorers from the far future have a daunting mission. To save humanity, they must build a craft capable of reaching the stars. The Voyage of the Iron Dragon is the concluding book in the Iron Dragon trilogy. The Iron Dragon trilogy is being produced as part of the phenomenally successful Saga of the Iron Dragon Kickstarter, which raised over $10,000. Meticulously researched and packed with action, The Dream of the Iron Dragon is a must for sci-fi and alternate history fans. Also, Book 2, The Dawn of the Iron Dragon, is available now from Audible.com. There's a link to it in the show notes. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Linda Cohen-Leugman on the show with me today. She has a fantastic new novel called The Wartime Sisters. And when you're hearing this, it should be available everywhere. This is a fantastic book, another great historical fiction that's bound to be a hit here for 2019. Welcome to the show, Linda.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to talk to you today.
I'm excited to have you. I think we've got a lot of great stuff to talk about. But before we do, we begin each show with the same question. And that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Well, I loved music when I was little. I loved Broadway shows and I loved musical scores. And when I was young, I had a book that was like the script of West Side Story and also Romeo and Juliet, which West Side Story takes its inspiration from. But I got that book maybe when I was 10 years old after I had seen like a local college production of West Side Story. And I loved reading the script and reading the lyrics to the words. So I actually, my first like dream before writing books was really, I really wanted to be a songwriter, but not like a pop songwriter, a Broadway musical writer. So, but I have no musical ability whatsoever. So I have to stick to words, and not get into the music side. So, that's probably when I, and then I started writing a lot of poetry, a lot of really terrible poetry after that. But that's like my first memory.
Like a lot of writers do.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of a rite of passage almost, writing really bad poetry.
I think so.
Yeah. I hear a lot of stories about people's first inspiration and the thing that wakes up the storytelling gene, if you will. And, Broadway musicals is not a very common, story that I hear. I love that. I love that.
Yeah. I don't know.
I think it's great. You know, music is always an inspiration. Lots of people draw inspiration from music, but there's something about the music from a musical play, where the music has kind of more storytelling power.
The music, usually those kinds of songs are put in, I didn't know this back then, of course, but I know it a little bit better now. They're put in, you know, for a specific reason, to move the story along. So the song shouldn't be just a song that's just a pretty melody. It should say something. And so I think what struck me about those songs in that particular play, which completely went over my head at the age of 10, but just that they were so clever. The word choices were so clever. The rhyme, the internal rhyming was so clever. And they told a specific story. Like each one could stand on its own. And I don't know, there was something about them I that just really spoke to me. And also I think it was seeing it on stage too. You know, seeing them performed on stage. And it wasn't Broadway. I mean, I didn't get to go to Broadway until I was much, much, much older, but didn't matter. You know, even seeing local college performers tell that story on stage was really magical, especially at that young age.
Did you ever try your hand at theater?
I did, yeah, when I was in high school. I think there are a lot of writers and creative. I mean, I think, you know, if you have that creative side to you, you kind of dabble in a lot of different things. So I did. When I was in high school, I did a lot of musical theater, which was a great time, and I really loved it. And now I live actually about an hour north of New York City, so I get to go in when I can, you know, and see shows, which is really wonderful.
Nice. Yeah, I think a lot of writers are frustrated actors or directors or playwrights. Because there's something about being in full control of the story and the performance, when you're a novelist, theater or movies or whatever is really a collaborative experience. But when you're a novelist, you're in full control of everything. And that's it's a great feeling.
It is a great feeling. You really get to decide everything when you write a story. You know, you can decide what everyone does and what everyone thinks. Maybe it's a little bit like being a director, although if you're a director of a movie or a play, you still have to, you can't control the actors completely. I've never done that, but I guess you can give them direction and ideas, but you have to let them have some autonomy. When you're the writer, your characters have no autonomy at all. You know, you can choose everything that they do, and you can put them through pain and suffering, and they can never get back at you.
So what did you study when you went to college?
I was an English major. And I spent a lot of my time in college just reading Victorian literature, and I loved it. I didn't know what to do really with it or with myself afterwards, and so I ended up going to law school. So I actually practiced as a lawyer for a long time. And I didn't love law school, and I didn't love being a lawyer, but I did, of all the kinds of law that one could practice, I was happy with the field that I was able to practice in, which was trust and estates. So like really families were the clients and individuals were the clients instead of companies or corporations or anything like that. And those were really the reason that I loved it was, you know, you learned people's stories, you learned right. people's personal stories. And there was a real kind of like therapist aspect to it. And you dealt with people, at times when they were very needy. I mean, on the estate planning side, you know, you're helping people kind of choose, or at least listening to them as they're debating with themselves and their spouses about who to choose, you know, to look after their children when they're something, if something should happen, you know, all those kinds of kind of heavy questions. And then on the estate administration side, you're helping people when they've lost someone. And so that there's a lot of drama, actually, you know, not all the time. Sometimes it's very straightforward, but there can be a lot of drama and there can be a lot of pain and there are, can be a lot of crazy things that you hear or that you're in the room for. And so that, you know, I always loved that part of it. I didn't like the tax law part of it or the, right. the legal part, which was in fact my clue that I should not continue, you know, with well, that forever.
Well, those are full of story too, but they're typically horror stories.
Yeah. yeah.
What drew you to Victorian literature?
I love an old fashioned story. I'm kind of, I don't love literature or stories always that are set in the present day. I can never write them for one thing. I mean, I really can't write them. But even when I read them, you know, a lot of people really only love that. They love reading something that they can really relate to, but I like getting lost in something that is past. It's much more comforting to me. I think I read as a comfort and as an escape. And so I just, there's something about the stories of that era that I just find very soothing. Even when they're tumultuous, I gravitate towards them.
So you go from Victorian literature and studying literature in college, then law school and practicing law. And I love how you made the connection to storytelling and, you know, dealing with people and getting their stories when you're practicing law. I believe that storytelling connects to just about every aspect of our life. And when we tell stories, that's really what we're doing. We are, telling stories about the human condition and how we connect with one another and how we're in conflict with one another. And, you know, the genre that we write in is a lot of times just kind of window dressing on those human stories that we're telling. What brought you from practicing law to wanting to write fiction?
So it's a little bit of a long story, but it was really, I always wanted to try, but I was really terrified about writing. I had never, although I studied, you know, in college, I never took a creative writing class ever. And, I kind of thought I might write children's books or maybe middle grade books. You know, I love, when I was a child, I loved Edward Eger's books, Half Magic and those. And I always kind of thought I would write a book like that, or I always wanted to write a book like that. And I would sit down and try for a little bit, but I would never really get anywhere. And then I got older and when my daughter was 6 months old, I came up with the idea for my first novel, which is The Two Family House. And that was really, the setting of it was based on my mom's childhood home because she grew up in a two-family house in Brooklyn, but there were just a lot of aspects of my early life that I've spoken about before that led me to come up with the idea for that story. And when I did, you know, I didn't write it down because I didn't know how, really. And I that was in 1999. My daughter just turned 20 a couple days ago. So a lot of things, I guess, happened. I thought about that story for years and years, and I kind of kept developing it in my head. And the characters came to me, and they sort of wouldn't leave me. And then, you know, I turned 40 years old, and a few years before that, my mom passed away. And I kind of, right after I turned 40, I kind of just had this feeling that if I didn't write that story down, I just never would. And so I decided to start taking a writing class at Sarah Lawrence, which is about 40 minutes from my house. And there was a class, I mean, that I really stumbled into because the timing worked with picking up my kids and dropping them off from school. It met from 11 to 1, which, as mothers, stay-at-home mothers know, is a good time to do something because you have a good window in the middle of the day. And I started taking this class, and I really learned so much from about how to write, what would resonate with people just sitting around that table with other writers. And it took me 5 years to write that book because I really didn't know. I didn't know if I would ever finish it. I didn't know if I ever could finish it, if I could ever be a real writer. But one of the things that I've learned that you need to do if you want to be a writer is to think of yourself as a writer and to say you're a writer and to just kind of put on that hat and not let anybody tell you that you're not. And so sitting in that class gave me that confidence. And then it was luck. I mean, when I was finished, I think it was just so much luck that I found my agent and that, you know, she was such a strong advocate for the book and that it sold, and then, you know, more luck for people to read it and like it. So.
Well, I really like what you say there about having the confidence to call yourself a writer. One of the terms that I hate the worst is aspiring writer. Because you either are or you're not. You know, you either sit down and write or you don't. And an aspiring writer to me is just someone sitting around thinking about writing. And you know, that's okay. You didn't take any creative writing courses when you were in college when you were younger, but at the Writing Institute at Sarah Lawrence College, other than the confidence to know that you could do it, did you pick up anything there that you can point to that you believe helped your writing?
You know, the class was a really interesting one because we read out loud. So, and I took that class for 5 years, even longer, like 6 or 7 years after my book came out, I still took the class. So it was a very unstructured class, and the assignment every week was the same. It was, you know, just bring in what you're working on, no more than 5 pages. And so we would go around the table and read to each other. And that was a great lesson because, first of all, when you read out loud, and now, even now, when I read all of my work out loud to myself or to my husband as much as he'll let me, you notice things when you read out loud about rhythm and word choice and repetition. Yes. And everything that you just can't do when you're just reading it on the page. But I learned about just what holds people's attention, because there were a lot of really talented writers in that class. And sometimes people would read something and you just, you know, it would like, it was like it flashed by in a second and you just wanted them to keep reading forever. And then some people would read 2 pages and it would just feel like it was going on for a year. And so you start to learn it wasn't any specific lessons, but you just start to learn just from doing and listening what holds people's interest and what works, and the variety of things people were reading around the class really helped. So that, just that kind of active learning was very important and really, really great for me. I do feel like I really would love to go and take more classes now at other places and go to writing retreats and things, because I know there's so much that I don't know. And there are things that I know just from doing them that then I might read about in a book on writing that the writer or the instructor will say to do. And I was never taught that specific lesson, but it's just things that I picked up from sitting around that table with those other writers. So I think I had a kind of strange, it was a little bit of a strange way to learn it, and I definitely should learn like the specific lessons also, and I hope to do that one day. But what I did learn was incredibly helpful, and I think it helped just with that kind of that connectivity, I guess is the right word, that should to help readers connect to what they're reading. So I don't think I write the most wonderful, literary, perfect books, but I think there's something in them that people can connect to in a simple way, which can still be powerful. And I think I learned that from just sitting and listening to other people read their work.
So it sounds like more writer's group than writing lecture.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That's great. That's, you know, you can, as a writer, you know, when you work on a book and you work on it for so long and you're getting, no input really from, you know, just yourself and the, you know, a few trusted people. And then the book goes to the world and you, it's kind of this long buildup to get any real feedback from, you know, from readers.
Yeah, it's
but
terrifying.
It is.
It's a terrifying time.
It is. But in this kind of situation, you kind of get to judge people's faces and their real emotional reactions. That's a fantastic thing.
It is. And I think it just gave me a lot of confidence. Even the only thing that I wrote before I wrote my first book, before I started that class, was a prologue for the book, which I kind of carried around with me forever. Like I wrote it on the computer or was it a typewriter? Like, I guess I wrote it on a computer, but I printed it out and I had it with me. And I just kind of kept it in a drawer in my nightstand, to tell you the truth, like forever. And so I brought that in the first day of class. And when I read it and people listened. First of all, it's like a very powerful thing to have anyone listen to what you wrote at all,
right.
You know, to share it with people and have them listen and have them talk about it seriously, even if you don't even think that it's a serious piece of writing, you know, to have people discuss it and debate it, it just gives it validity, you know, and that's a gift. So that was a very special time.
So let's talk about the two family house for just a second. I know
sure.
It was inspired by your mother and her upbringing, but what is it about this brownstone in this story that kind of came alive to you? And who are the characters that we meet in this story?
So when I was growing, you know, my mom grew up in a two family house with her two sisters, and then my grandmother's brother lived downstairs and he had three daughters of his own. So there were six girls in that house and they were very close and just kind of, it was a very fluid kind of thing. They were upstairs and downstairs and my grandmother would feed them all. And, you know, I would hear all the stories, from my aunts, my mother, their cousins, my grandmother. And my grandmother, as a result of kind of having three daughters and three nieces, by the time she had grandchildren and I was born, she would say to me how she always wished that she had a boy. And that kind of, I didn't love that when I was growing up because I was not a boy. I was a girl and I had an older brother who was her first grandchild and she really doted on him. And so that kind of, she said it a lot. So it made me think about it a lot. And then, you know, if you flash forward to when I got married and eventually I got pregnant, I used to talk to her on the phone because she lived till she was 92 years old. So she was around for a long time. And I talked to her on the phone and I would joke with her, you know, that and tell her that I wanted to have a girl because she would always tell me she wanted a boy. The thing was, though, I wasn't really just joking. I really did want a girl. And I felt all this guilt about the fact that I wanted a girl because I knew, and she used to say to me that the most important thing was for the child to be healthy and it didn't matter what the sex of the child was, which intellectually I knew, but I had this gut feeling that I wanted a girl. And I did have a girl. And then later I had a boy, so I have one of each. But when my daughter was 6 months old, I read that there was an article on the front page of the New York Times magazine, and it was called Getting the Girl, and it was by a journalist named Lisa Belkin, and she had written an article about a new technology for people who to go to this company, and if you wanted a child of a certain gender, it was not a guarantee, but it was a process where they would spin sperm in a centrifuge, and you know, the heavier one, depending on the chromosome, one's heavier than the other, and they do artificial insemination, and you have a better chance of getting this the gender child that you want. And that was in 1999, and at that time it was this, you know, big breakthrough in technology. And the report was about how this company for the first time was seeing more requests for girls than boys, and people wanted girls. And the journalist interviewed a bunch of women who had all boys and really wanted girls. And there were, when I read that story, I was struck by how sad and desperate a lot of those women were, because they had multiple boys, you know, two or three or four boys, and they just wanted a girl so badly. And it made me really think about my own thoughts before I had my child, and what, you know, would I have done that? Would I have gone with, like, to such extremes and, you know, for just to have a girl? And would my grandmother have, if it had been available to her time, you know, to her in her day? And that story really, like, something in me clicked after I read it, and I just thought of this idea of my mother's childhood home, but with these different occupants. So instead of three girls upstairs and three girls downstairs, I have Helen and Abe with their four boys upstairs, and then Abe's brother Mort living downstairs with his wife Rose and their three girls. And because they have these extreme situations with so many children of the single sex, everybody wants what they don't have, and there's tension that develops because of it. And that's how that story kind of came to play. Because in the house where my mother grew up, my grandmother and her sister-in-law were very, very close. But I thought, you know, what if one of them had a boy? You know, back then, boys really were, they were revered. You know, you wanted a son to carry on your family name and carry on your family business. And so what if one of those girls had been a boy? Or, you know, what would anything have changed? You know, would there have been tension that hadn't been there before? So that was how that story kind of came to be.
And that story was very well received, over 1,000 reviews on Amazon, and people love that story. What do you think it is about telling these historical stories that are, you know, slightly removed from present life, that makes it so easy to escape into? And why do you think that we love these kinds of stories? I know that you said it's difficult for you to write a current story, but, you know, as readers, we love to kind of escape to a time that maybe seems more simple, but then when you start scratching the surface, you know, life is always complicated. What do you think it is about these stories that we love so much?
Yeah, well, the 40s and 50s, you know, we do idealize them, I think. I think people like family stories a lot. And so that's what really interests me, is the dynamics of family, of siblings, of in-laws, of mothers and children. And I think we all have families, so we can all relate in some way. And I think we see our own families when we read about others. I think it's a reminder to try to have compassion. It's, you know, I hope that it's kind of a call to empathy, that, you know, you don't really ever know every side to every story, and that you can't know what everyone has been through. And it just makes you, it gives you some insight, you know, peek maybe into what someone else is feeling. And I think with the Two Family House, I was so moved and so honored, because so many readers wrote to me and wrote emails to me about their own families and how these characters, you know, really spoke to them, because they reminded them so much, you know, of their own families, of their mothers, of someone that they knew, you know, of their uncle or whatever it was. And that was very moving to me, you know, to think that someone read what I wrote and connected to it that way. So I think the family piece is a big part of it.
Sure. Well, you have followed up that book with your new book that's out now when people are hearing this. It's called The Wartime Sisters. And we turn the calendar back a few more years and we're during World War II. There've been some really phenomenal books that have come out over the last year, maybe year and a half, dealing with this time period and really showing us stories from this period that get lost. The farther we get from a historical event, the more that event gets reduced to kind of bullet points. And, whereas when you and I were in school, we might have spent a lot more time on World War II, and now our kids, you start learning less and less because there are so many more, history keeps moving on.
My daughter is in college, and she took a history class on the 1980s.
Oh my goodness, no.
The 1980s is history now. But, yeah. I mean, so definitely.
Wow.
I agree 100%.
Yeah, when parachute pants start becoming fodder for history class, it's pretty bad.
Yeah.
But, we're getting, a lot of people are interested in this time period and not just the historical facts of battles and things like that, but the stories of the people that lived through this. And I absolutely love it. And I'm so glad that that readers are really, latching on to this time period and to these stories because we're losing people from there, and these stories will be gone forever if we don't capture these. Tell us about what was it about the Wartime Sisters that got you excited to write this book? And did the characters come to you first? Was there some external inspiration? Kind of where did the story come from?
So I wanted to write another family story, and with the two-family house, like I said, the inspiration for the setting came from my mom's childhood family home. But my mom moved to Springfield, Massachusetts when she was 18 years old. And she actually, her family moved first, and she was finishing her senior year in high school, so she stayed behind with relatives and then went there. And all the stories that I had heard about Springfield and that move were always, like, they thought they had been exiled to the North Pole. It was to go from Brooklyn to Western Massachusetts to go from a lively city to what was for them a very sleepy small town, even though for other people, Springfield might seem like a big and vibrant city. But I just had this idea initially that I wanted to capture something about sisters in transition and sisters kind of somebody left behind. And just like, I just had a lot of ideas floating around in my head, but I knew that I wanted to set it in Springfield. And that was just something that was kind of itching at me. And I had this idea that I was going to have a character with a backstory of having worked at the Springfield Armory during World War II. So she was going to be an older character, and the story was going to be maybe more in the 50s and 60s. But there was a character with that backstory. So I had to go and research the Springfield Armory. And even though in my mind, it was going to be a page at most about what this woman did there, but I had no idea what she might've done there. I knew about the Springfield Armory because I grew up about 15 minutes from it. I had never visited it before. I really didn't know much about it, but I knew that a lot of women worked there during World War II because that was just what had happened, in all of these factories and defense plants. So I started poking around. And when you said before, you talk about losing people who were living right during that time period. I'm so glad that the Armory, which is now part of the National Park System, has this website. Because on this website, one of the first things I found were these oral histories that had been recorded, I think in the 1980s, of women that had worked at the Armory, men too. And some of them were just civilians who worked there, and some of them were people who lived there. There were children of officers who lived on the grounds of the armory, and a woman who was the wife of a commanding officer who lived on the grounds of the army. And not all of them were there during World War II. Most of them were, but not all of them. And their stories were just so fascinating. And I was listening to them, and they were very varied. So like some, you know, like I said, there's a woman who was the wife of an officer. There was a woman who put together triggers and was a single mom at a very young age and didn't have a lot of education. There was a woman who, you know, kind of went into their training program for like engineering, you know, things. They were really like a very, very diverse group of characters. And when I listened to their stories, it just was so rich with detail. And the armory was just clearly not what I thought it was. I thought it was like a single building. I thought it was just a factory where people went. I had no idea that people lived there. I had no idea that it was actually like this huge park-like campus. And the armory grounds now are actually a college campus. It's part of Springfield Technical Community College. And there's still the original arsenal that's there. But I, you know, when I listened to those voices, I just couldn't stop. So there are hours and hours and hours of recordings, and I just listened for hours and hours. And I just started researching more and more and more, and then I had to go visit. And so as I was researching, I was developing the idea of these sisters. And then when I went for my first visit, I toured the grounds with the guy who's the curator of the museum, and he was really kind and took me all around. And I got to go into what used to be the commanding officer's residence, which is kind of like this big old mansion. And you could rent it for events if you want, you know, to have a party there or whatever. And then a lot of other buildings. So I was able to go into one of the buildings that was officer residence for two families. And it was just this, the campus is filled with these charming, beautiful, beautiful buildings that, I mean, anybody would be just like in heaven to have as their home. And there were tennis courts there and a swimming pool and gardens, just beautiful gardens. When you look at the old photos, there were rose arbors, and, you know, the Work Progress Administration was hired, you know, and had a team of gardeners working there and arborists and all these things. And so it was like a park, you know, on one side. And then the other side was where all the factory buildings were. But there wasn't just one, as I had assumed. There were just so many. And in fact, there are so many buildings there that they gave them all numbers. So there were over 100 buildings, and they gave them numbers instead of names. So in the book, you know, the sister that I have living there lives in building 5/6, which is actually a building that I was able to go into when I was there. But the different buildings, they were just all numbered because they couldn't name all of them. And it just, you know, after I visited it and I saw sort of the two sides, this very, what was once a very pristine and park-like side with these beautiful homes, and then the factory side, it just made me think about the sisters even more. And the sisters in my story are real opposites. And the armory itself is kind of two places at once. You know, there was the factory side where civilians who lived in Springfield or around Springfield would come to work. And then there was this side that was more like an army base with this very, you know, lovely setting. So it helped to me to differentiate between my two characters. It helped me to kind of come up with more conflict for them and reasons for their conflict. And I knew that I wanted them to reunite there because my idea was that they would be estranged for many years and that would be the place where they would reunite. And because of the place that it is, it wouldn't make it easy for them. So that's sort of how it came to be.
So the story is set during this time period, and with the conflicts that come with women being pressed into service.
You?
Oh, hello. Oh, are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I had muted my mic accidentally.
Oh, okay.
I was saying that the book takes place during this time period, and that's a great setting for conflict and all of the the travails that are going on. It would, you know, lots of women were pressed into service and that sort of thing. But at the core, this is a family drama, a lot yeah. like your previous book. What do you feel like, or how do you feel that the setting and the time period and the conflict that was going on, how do you think that affected the telling of this family drama?
Well, you know, it kind of is two things at once, this book. It is like, it's a family story, a sister story, and then it's a World War II home front story. And right. I think having the tension of the war in the background is a great kind of simmering, you know, setting.
It's a great stressor, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a great stressor. And the idea that one of the sisters, I don't want to give away too much, but the idea that one of the sisters has lost someone and is dealing with this, you know, this terrible loss, that adds to the stress and to the heightened emotion of the story. Because, of course, you know, you want the other sister to be sympathetic. You want her to be welcoming. And when those things don't always happen the way that they would with, you know, sisters who totally get along perfectly, that creates more conflict and more drama. And then there's just this whole idea of kind of this army-based setting, you know, where you have different other characters and you have people who aren't necessarily so welcoming to an outsider, or to someone who they feel threatened by. So there's a character in the story who just really doesn't like it that a single woman is living in this officer housing, because she feels that it's supposed to be for officers and their families. And who is this, you know, woman who's just kind of popped in, and a very beautiful young woman at that, who's popped in and is going to be a temptation to the husbands that are around. And, you know, she just doesn't approve at all. So there was kind of a hierarchy, I think, of women and their husbands, and the arrival of my character at the armory upsets some of that. So that becomes problematic. And then, of course, if you have two sisters living in one house together, that when they haven't for a very long time, that can be not so easy or simple.
Yeah. Well, the book is absolutely fantastic. It's out everywhere now. The Wartime Sisters, Linda. This, you know, when we're recording this, a couple of weeks before the book is actually available, but it's already gotten lots of advanced praise. Some of my favorite historical fiction authors and folks that have been guests on the show before, like Pam Jenoff and Jenna Bloom, Christina McMorris, Fiona
They're also
Davis.
Wonderful.
I know, and they, you know, it was one of the, when I first got the book, I started seeing all of the advanced praise from authors that I trust and that whose work I love. And yeah, this is a tremendous book. You have really put together a fantastic look into this time period and into how people were affected. I love it. I think it's going to do great things this year. If people are just learning about you and your work, is there a place where they can find you online to kind of dig into all that you do and follow news and events?
Yeah, sure. I'm probably most active on Facebook. So I have an author page on Facebook. And if you just look for, it's Linda Cohen Loigman, author. And then I do have Twitter. I will post news and stuff on Twitter. And I have an Instagram also. So on Twitter, I'm at Linda C. Loigman, and Instagram, I think I'm just Linda Loigman. There aren't very many Loigmans in the world. So
right.
if you just put in Loigman, you'll probably find me pretty easily. And probably every other Loigman that you find is somehow related to my husband. So,
love it.
Yeah, it's not a common name, so you'll find me.
And I'll link up all of that in the show notes over at hankgarner.com. Linda,
great.
I love what you're doing. I love the book. I wish you much success on it. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for all your great questions. And it was just a pleasure.
A revolutionary quantum teleportation device promises to bring humanity one step closer to the stars until it fails spectacularly. The
Translocator from M.G. Herron, available now on audible.com. Go to mgherron.com/ASP. Archaeologist Eliana Fisk is ripped from Earth while the whole world watches. She lands on a strange new world inhabited by a lost tribe of ancient Mayans. Meeting them, getting first-hand exposure to age-old customs and rituals. It seems like an archaeologist's dream. But what if the rituals have a darker meaning? What if the god these people pray to is no god at all? And how in the world will she ever get back home? Thus begins a pulse-pounding race against time that hurls Eliana into a great unknown, revealing ancient technologies and marvelous mysteries more outlandish than she ever imagined. The Translocator is an action-packed sci-fi thriller perfect for fans of Stargate, The Atlantis Gene, and other archaeology-inspired science fiction adventures. Pick it up today. Go to mgherron.com/ASP. That's mgherron.com/ASP. The Translocator by M.G. Herron. Thanks for listening to the Author Stories Podcast. For more great author interviews like this one, go to hankgarner.com and dig through the archives. There's something there I know you'll love. Now stay tuned for a special audio clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane series.
I was 10 years old when I saw my first ghost. The year was 1770. My father was a barber. He kept a small shop at the Kuenhoven Inn, where the King's Road met the Old Loop. Our modest home lay to the north, between the inn and the hanging tree. A simple box of pine boards, whitewashed with crushed oyster shell. One room, with a spinning wheel for mother, a chair for father, and up a ladder of branches, a garret where my parents slept. I slept on the floor below, alongside my little brother, Hans, 5 years younger than I. Our floor sloped toward the Hudson, so that when Hans rolled over in his sleep, he often went on rolling and couldn't stop, collecting splinters and grievances. Yet on this particular night, he slept peacefully, and I was the fitful one. A mouse had taken shelter in our wall, fleeing the October chill. It scritched and scratched, nibbling a nest for itself. The sound thrilled me. I possessed a vivid mind, full of toadstools and bullfrogs and lightning storms, and so imagined a skeleton writhed in the wood. The bones of Anne Underhill, perhaps, murdered by Indians at Spook Rock. I'd heard that tale from my father, who reveled in the Dutch superstitions. He would gather us to fireside on winter nights and spin tales of the Heer of Dunderberg, that storm king who rattled our white windows, of the Lady of Raven Rock, who died in snowfall, pining for her lover, of trolls beneath the Penny Bridge and hobgoblins in the hanging tree. He'd filled my head with such dark romance that I lay waiting for Anne's little finger bones to drag me off to some bloody fate. I rather hoped she would. A cloud cleared the moon, and a square of light fell on my mother's spinning wheel. The sharp spindle glinted, and the wheel began to turn, without touch. A figure appeared before me, as through a mist, a gray head bent to the work. She fixed me with eyes black as open graves and whispered in a low, guttural hiss, "Spin, or you shall not eat." I cried out and fell to my pallet, arms over my head. Hans awoke, lost his balance, and rolled away, bleeding with pain as he struck the riverside wall. Father emerged above.
"Agatha, what is wrong?"
"There's a ghost, Papa. A ghost, help me." Hans laughed despite his bruises, and Mother moaned and ordered us to sleep. But Papa descended and took my hands, his blue eyes twinkling.
"What did you see?"
"An old woman. She said, 'Spin or you shall not eat.'"
"Oh."
He raised a candle beneath his chin.
"You saw old Willow. She lived here long ago, when this was the home of Isaac Hart, our candlemaker. Her husband was killed by savages. Hart took her in at the request of Lord Phillips, who paid a token sum for her upkeep. But Hart was greedy and kept the money for himself. He never fed her unless she spun. So Willow spun and spun and spun, like a spider, year by year, growing old and blind and falling to waste. She died at that spinning wheel, fell over one day, and the spindle pierced her heart. Hans screamed and hid beneath the table. Mother appeared above.
Daniel Van Ripper, you are a fool.
I kissed Papa's fingers, for I loathed that spinning wheel.
I'd be no toothless ghost, spinning and haunting little girls.
I felt pity for such a spirit, and gratitude to have her example before me, stealing my resolve. Every night thereafter, I would leave a crust of bread for old Willow, and sleep with one eye open, in case she came to spin for me again.